Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Stranded and I'm so lost, my mind is wired. Overcome and overdone, my fate is on fire.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Tegan Rain Quinn and Sarah Kirsten Quinn were born 8 minutes apart, a little more than 39 years ago in Calgary. The identical twins have been closest companions, best friends, nemeses, and alter egos since, and also, since their mid-teens, musical and creative partners. 2 decades into their professional career, the duo has succeeded in multiple genres of pop music and indie rock, while establishing themselves as openly queer artists and activists. Their new memoir and album explore themes of vulnerability and bravado, sexuality and ambition, drawing on the raw lyrics and memories of their teenage days. This hour on Point, my conversation with Tegan and Sarah about high school and high hopes. We'd like you to join us. What questions do you have for Tegan and Sarah? What have their songs meant to you? What about their activism? With us from Boston are Tegan and Sarah Quinn. The award-winning sisters have jointly written a new memoir called High School, and they constructed their new album, Hey, I'm Just Like You, after finding cassette tapes from their childhood home. It features original recordings from those earliest songs. Tegan Quinn, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much. I'm thrilled to be here.
And Sarah Quinn, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm experiencing you guys, I think, just like a lot of your listeners do. I'm in New York. You're in Boston. I'm hearing you through equivalent of earbuds. I can't see you. This means two things. First off, just free word of advice. If you say anything, it's live radio. If you say anything that you think is really dumb or stupid, pretend you're the other for that moment. Blame her. And the second thing is I may ask from time to time to make sure we're clear on who's talking at the moment because we're experiencing you in stereo, in effect. Let me ask you, why don't I start with you, Sarah? Why did you guys return to high school? You were writing this memoir. It's called High School by Tegan and Sarah. Why did you guys decide to write?
We had talked about taking some time to focus on other creative projects. We weren't feeling like getting back into the studio and recording music, but we were feeling really creative and collaborative. And we had thrown around the idea of writing. We weren't sure what it would look like, if it would be a collection of essays or stories and accounts from our years of touring. But we sat down with our book agent, and it was sort of a bit of a brainstorm session. But I had really become preoccupied with this idea that there was an opportunity to sort of tell the origin story of Tegan and Sarah, the right before we got famous kind of moment where everything was sort of falling into place, both with our relationship as twins and as sisters, but also as queer women and artists who had figured out, you know, their songwriting craft. And I just I liked the idea. I'm more a little bit more structured and disciplined in some ways. And so Tegan was a little bit more like, why don't we talk about our childhood and adolescence? And I was like, why don't we just focus on these specific years, these 3 years that were so seminal and so important in what would become our public-facing career eventually.
So basically behind the music. It's a VH1 special, but it's, you know, written in chapter form. Tegan, I got to say, you know, in reading this, I enjoyed it. I may be a little more removed from high school days, but, you know, it evoked that time and a real sense of place. But also, you guys alternated chapters clearly quite intentionally, and you have very distinct voices there. There's really distinctive, you know, very distinctive personalities and sensibilities emerged.
Yeah, and that, I mean, honestly, you just struck something that was really important to us, which was that, you know, as musicians and as a duo and collaborators for the last 20 years, we've sort of marked everything as Tegan and Sarah. Obviously, fans are people who really dive into the band. They'll know who sings what, but we don't write together. We don't craft our songs together. We do it all separately. And so when we started to work on the book, we wanted to follow that same path because we're so comfortable. So we wanted to write our own chapters and our own story. And the goal would be very similar to making a record, to find a cohesive through line to make sure that it wasn't, you know, a terrible read. You know, even though Sarah and I had lived in the same house and were identical twins, we had a very different experience growing up. And I think that became very clear even to us as we read the book. As we wrote the book and I got Sarah's chapters, I was struck by how different her interior voice was, how different her experience around sexuality had been, or some of the tension and anxiety she felt around our career as we neared the end of high school and we got offered a record deal. Like, I had really even I had miscalculated or misunderstood how different Sarah and I had been. And that really sparked me to want to put this book out and to put a lot of us into it, because I think there is a misconception that because we're twins and because we're so close, we must have had the same experience. And
because
really
you are identical twins.
Yeah.
So a lot of people who don't follow you may confuse one for the other. They may think, oh, these are just carbon copies. Clearly not.
No. And I think even we do it. And I think this was a cathartic experience for us. Nobody likes looking back at their younger years. But I think for Sarah and I, the more time we spent in that time frame, we understood each other better. But I think also we've become a lot more compassionate and tender towards our younger selves. And I think that's, I hope, a takeaway for anyone who reads this book or listens to our new record or comes to see us, is that I think collectively we could all probably be a little easier on our younger selves.
Sarah Quinn, I want to talk maybe at the beginning of the second segment a bit about, because I wanted to have time to breathe, a bit about, you know, the question of your sexuality, sort of understanding it, coming to terms with it, wrestling with it, coming out. But I wonder if there are ways in which, as Tegan just suggested, you also have become a little bit more forgiving, perhaps, of your younger self, of where you were at the point that you're writing about here in high school itself.
I don't think I'd ever really considered that what I felt in high school, those struggles that I had around what was happening for me internally, like how I was feeling and thinking, but also the actions that I was taking. I mean, I was having secret relationships with girls all throughout my adolescence, and in most cases, you know, keeping that entirely a secret, even from Tegan. And I had never really gone back and thought very hard about why I had done that. There was opportunities, many opportunities to share with people, friends, my parents. There was certainly – it was not the kind of environment it is today, but it wasn't hostile. My mom did come to me at different times in my adolescence and say, like, you know, if you're experimenting or you're having these feelings, like, that's okay. But it never had occurred to me to go back and really think about what had caused me to stay secret and quiet about these things. And for me, writing the book, I really looked at internalized homophobia and the, you know, the sort of environment I was raised in the 1990s in a conservative time where, you know, to be gay was really sort of, there was no future for me that I could imagine. And any queer people that I was familiar with were either, on the news because of, like, I'm thinking in the late 80s and early 90s, what I would have picked up from watching TV or movies, it would have been around HIV/AIDS. It would have been around, hate crimes and violence, or the butt of a joke at a dinner, or, you know, working on my dad, with my dad and my stepdad. They both worked in construction. You know, derogatory, homophobic words were used all the time. There was no positive representation for me. And so to go back to our, you know, to our adolescence and start to really draw that line of, like, okay, this is where this internalized homophobia began. And some of these things that I've felt difficulty with over the years, I don't think I would say things like, oh, you know, I have low self-esteem, or I don't always feel very good about myself. Or if, you know, and to be the butt of a joke, I might say, like, oh, I hate myself, or I'm the worst. But when I really started to unpack that, I realized that a lot of my shame around my body and my identity, my desires, or my, you know, the person that I was then and am now, a lot of it was because of internalized homophobia.
Accompanying your joint memoir is this album, Hey, I'm Just Like You. The lead single on it's called I'll Be Back Someday, from Tegan and Sarah's new album. Let's take a listen.
Sit and watch my TV set. What is on will make it better. We'll make it better. I want to call and ask what's up. Go to dial, but then I stop. Why don't you call? To the end, my friend. Oh, what a lie. Oh, what a lie. If I could pretend, if I could lie.
All right, who wrote that one?
Well, we think probably the majority of it was written by Sarah, but it's actually I stitched together two demos in the pre-production process, and so I think both were written sort of by both Sarah and I, but it's
my memory is that Sarah wrote the bulk of it.
I love the fact that it's old enough that you're like, I think that's me. Is that me in the profile in that photograph? You're like, is that me?
That's the joy of this project was that for the first time in our entire career, we weren't so the ownership of songs was probably at an all-time low in terms of importance. It was more about who's inspired by what part of what song is inspiring you. And so this is, I would say, truly the first ever Tegan and Sarah record where we collaborated on every single song. We shared duties as vocal or lead singers on every single song. So, ownership wasn't as important. It's a whole new era for us.
All right, Tegan, so there's about a minute and a half left before we take our first little break. Tell listeners a little bit about the process. Like, you guys didn't go in saying, and we'll also do an album. Like, you were scouting around for stuff to figure out what to write, right?
Yeah. When we were writing the book, I found all these cassette tapes with our early demos, and I was really struck by how great they were. You know, I'd sort of done what most people...
That's a pretty brilliant song. And the fact you guys were teenagers,
I know.
My God.
I know. Thank you. I know. Sarah cringes when I say it, but I think we were really good when we were young. We had sort of...
And that, by the way, folks, is the Tegan-Sarah divide, right?
I think so,
yes. You're willing to, you know, beat your chest and say, hey, we kind of rock.
Sarah always says that we would be insufferable if we were both like me. And we would be insufferable if we were both like Sarah. We balance each other. But I don't know. I heard the songs and I was really struck. I didn't realize how much of the Tegan and Sarah sound was already there when we first started writing. I think I thought that we'd just created that sound over time and we'd been influenced by, you know, producers or writers or what, I don't know what I thought. But I was wrong. And I heard the tapes and I thought we should – re-record these. We should make a record. And, you know, it took a little coercing to get Sarah on board. But once we finished the book, we jumped right into pre-production and started to work on the record.
We're discussing the music, career, and life journey of Tegan and Sarah with Tegan and Sarah. They're sticking around. We hope you will, too. You can join our conversation. What questions do you have for the duo? What songs speak to you or spoke to a younger you? We'll be back in a moment, but I'd like to close out this segment with Walking with a Ghost, and that's off Tegan and Sarah's 2004 album, So Jealous. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Late at night, when your words are eating me alive, does it make you sad to leave me here like that?
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking with the musical duo Tegan and Sarah. You just heard the track Hold My Breath Until I Die. That's off their new album, Hey, I'm Just Like You. You can join our conversation. What stands out to you about Tegan and Sarah's music? What themes of their music or their activism appeal to you? Follow us on Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us are Tegan and Sarah Quinn, their new memoir, High School, and as I said, their latest album, Hey, I'm Just Like You. Sarah, you've wrote a lot about how important it was. You know, we just heard lyrics, late at night when your words are eating me alive, does it make you sad to leave me here like that? There's a lot of raw emotion and people sometimes diminish that as, you know, well, it's high school angst and whatever. But, you know, you guys write in the book how this is, you know, this was like life and death stuff to you. This was meaningful. At one point, Sarah, you write in here about your feelings about Naomi, who's one of the first girls you dated, right? Mm-hmm. And it was a secret involvement. And you said you wrote about there's a line you say, you go away, but I'm still here. You lie, but I still miss you. You lie, but I still need you. And you wrote, to date, my songs had mostly been written about other people, characters, or abstractions. I moved the words I couldn't say to Naomi in my letters or over the telephone straight to my songs. And you say that you're embarrassed to play the song for Tegan. And you write, I realized that for the first time since we'd started writing songs, I hadn't designated anything for her to sing. It was important for these words to remain mine and mine alone. How much did your music enable you to kind of articulate and grapple with your feelings, both as a young woman evolving in adolescence, and also as somebody recognizing her own sexuality and orientation might not be something that everybody fully embraced?
I mean, I think that at the time, of course, it's easy to add this kind of adult voice and perspective as I'm writing the memoir 22 years later. Mm-hmm. There was so much evidence, whether it was in the lyrics that I had saved from high school or listening to the songs, even in some of the letters that I saved between Naomi and I, my best friend and first secret girlfriend. There was so much evidence that I was struggling with the gravity of my real sexuality and identity, and my knowledge that this was not like an accident. This was not a one-time thing. This was something that I sort of knew, down to my bones. I just knew that this was me, and I was struggling to even tell the person I was having a relationship with. I mean, we were really, we were very much teenagers, just sort of acting on desire, and we weren't having sexual relationships and then talking about it the way that we would as adults. I mean, we were really sort of, we were awkward and shy and impulsive, and I think there was a reprieve for me to be able to sing about it or to write somewhat abstractly, but also to start to put a finer point on it by writing these songs to the girl that I was struggling to have these conversations with. There was a sort of relief in being able to do that, at least within the music, context.
It struck me also that this was something that you were writing to girls. You were clear about it. And yet you were having to also deal with your own family. Tegan, you basically were able to walk through this pretty easily. And, you got off basically scot-free. And Sarah, you were taking it on the chin with your mom. I don't remember which one of you wrote that, God, Mom, if you tell me one more time that you kissed a girl when you were 15. But basically, you were kind of warding your mom off. And Sarah, man, this was hard on you.
Yeah, and I don't want to throw Tegan under the bus. I think that for her, she ended up in a very unique situation where, she had a boyfriend through much of high school, and they were very close, and I think that for Tegan, it just ended up that that her sort of, she calls it her sexual awakening, happened later in high school. But yeah, I knew as of grade 9, I knew that this thing with Naomi was going to start happening, and it was very difficult to keep under wraps. And so my mother was laser focused on me, and she certainly had her suspicions, as did Tegan. Tegan says now she didn't really quite know or understand what we were doing, but she knew something was going on. And I definitely felt like I was fending off the inquiries from my family members and friends, and I felt very panicked. I wanted to both protect and hide what was happening for me.
And Tegan, it seemed as though, you're dealing with this perhaps, as you say, a little bit later, a little more confidently as a result. But, you guys are also dealing with, I guess there's the male teacher who teaches your communication class that got you to the equipment that allowed you to play around and figure this stuff out, right? And it turns out he's gay and supportive of the two of you, ultimately. But he's sort of like a silent ally, where you guys are a little bit kind of mocking him, as one does older teachers who don't seem to get it. But he got more than you realized.
Yeah. Well, actually, there were two teachers. One was a drama teacher, and he was the one that we imagined, or at least estimated or hypothesized, was gay. And he was very supportive and put up with our shenanigans. And then, yeah, this broadcasting and communications teacher you speak of, Sarah and I were profoundly affected by him because, we didn't really necessarily love the class. It was mostly about learning how to do radio, actually. But
boring.
But
hey, wait a second.
But he just wanted us to do anything, something. So he started letting our class engineer and help us make demos. And going back to what you were talking about with Sarah, I think for me,
you know, we discovered the guitar and started writing songs in grade 10. And I do think that a lot of the confusion and anxiety and questions I had about who I was as a person, I used music right away as a way to process who I was. And I know Sarah was doing that as well, but I was doing that pre-having relationships. And so I think I was watching Sarah and, you know, and using music to sort of explore who I thought I might be, that by the time I got to the point where I had a relationship with my best friend and figured out a big part of who I was, which was going to be, of course, a queer person or a gay person, I had already had time to prepare. And music had become, you know, this vehicle for me to share that. Even if I didn't 100% think people understood who I was or what I was saying, I started to trickle out parts of who I was in the music. And I'm so grateful for those two teachers, because those were these, you know, incredible creative playgrounds for us, where we got to really unravel the more stressed out, anxious, closed parts of ourselves and really open up and be more childlike and be more youthful and to allow our creativity to come out of us. And I think when you're a creative person, you get to just be a little strange, and that sort of becomes your cloak, if you will, like it's a bit of a costume. And so
your calling card, here
yeah.
I am.
Yeah. And I think that for us, like, you know, with the combination of being very creative people, also growing up in the mid-90s when rave culture was so big, we were actually able to hide a little more easily our identity as queer people.
I think of it less as hiding and more like blending in.
Blending in. We didn't stick out so much. Like, it wasn't, you know, even if we had been a couple years younger, you know, after we graduated, obviously music and culture and the way people dressed, it really changed. And I think we would have really stuck out. And instead of sticking out, we did have this incredible group of friends where we were able to sort of, I do want to use the word hide. We were hiding in plain sight, but we had this incredible group of people around us that weren't all gay. And it was an interesting time. And music really was the language that helped me to figure out who I was.
You guys were hiding in plain sight and then hiding in plain sight behind microphones being amplified to growing crowds,
yeah.
too. I want to play one of your songs from the new album. This song is Hello, I'm Right Here, sort of on point there, from the new album. Hey, I'm Just Like You. It was written by Sarah back when they were in high school.
Right now, I wish I was older. Till I've done all that I can,
all that.
Till I've done all that I can. And so I said, hello, 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 I'm right here. Oh, hello, 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 I'm right here.
Sarah has written, I have a visceral memory of sitting down to write the song Hello at the end of grade 12. And Sarah, you wrote that you'd been devastated by a girl named Zoe. You said, I loved her. And she was like, I don't like girls. That was kind of how she approached it. We've got a bunch of people calling in from all over. Love to connect them with you. A call now from M from Portland, Maine. Thanks for listening, M. What are your questions for Sarah and Tegan?
Hello. I mostly just wanted to say, like, thank you so much for making your music and putting it out in the world. I was like in middle school when I got into the con. Shortly after it came out, a friend showed it to me, and it was just like, it was so hard. I mean, like, especially as like queer femme people, you just kind of have to come out again and again.
Mm-hmm.
And again, and I just like being able to see you both, and I'm like, look, there are queer creative people like making things and like being people out in the world. Like, I can do that and be that too. So like, you all were very important to me growing up.
Oh, thank you.
That's lovely, Em. I would like to take another call from this time from New Haven, Connecticut. Cassidy, thanks for calling in.
Thank you so much. This is really exciting for me. I grew up listening to If It Was You basically from middle school through today. I'm an identical twin, and only after high school did I realize how much that helped sort of keep me confident and sort of secure in high school. And I'm curious how you guys think your relationship as identical twins affected your ability to sort of develop your creativity and your artistic process. And, you know, continue on to fame.
Awesome, Cassidy. Let's throw that to them. And thanks for calling. And thanks for listening to the show.
Oh, that is a great question, Cassidy. I think
which one of you is it?
This is Tegan.
Let me know.
This
Tegan,
is Tegan,
go for it.
I'm so well trained. My second sentence was going to be the thing is that with Sarah and I do this on the street
done.
Too when I run
nicely
into people.
Done.
I have to alert.
So
people.
Basically, it's like you're perennially hosting a radio show in
yes,
your entire life. You
my
guys walk into a
life.
Starbucks and say, and I'd like to turn to my fellow coffee drinker, comma Sarah, comma.
You've literally seen me in a Starbucks, apparently.
No doubt.
Yeah, so I think for Sarah and I, being identical twins was mostly a great thing. I think it's a lot of the cliches where it felt like we often felt really grateful to have, a partner in crime and to have someone there with us on the first day of school. And I think it helped us to be unique and stand out. And I think we understood and learned very young how to manipulate that power. But I also think for Sarah and I, we both experienced some stress around it as well, especially in high school, as we tried to carve out space for ourselves and become independent people. There was this constant pushing us back together. We often felt like the harder we pulled apart, the more the magnet inside of us grew stronger. And, I think we did fight a lot. And I think that was just us trying to carve out space for ourselves and certainly around our sexual identity. Sarah explains it as feeling almost like the more sloppy I got with showing off that I was gay, it almost – Sarah felt like I was exposing both of us. And so I think that was another layer to the conflict that we had, which was that, by having an identical twin trailing you, it was like you had to learn how to control both of you and also how to protect both of you and hide both of you. And so I think it was both a good thing and a bad thing for sure.
Like to take a call now from Cary, North Carolina, Gayathri. Thank you so much for calling in, Gayathri. What do you think of Tegan and Sarah? What questions do you have for them?
Hi. I'm just calling largely to say that I've been a huge fan of Tegan and Sarah since high school and the music and also the many, many YouTube videos of the concerts and the banter. And I guess as somebody who's been really into music for a long time, a lot of the bands that I would listen to a lot in middle school and high school don't exist anymore. But I think it's really great how you guys have been able to evolve your career and like stay putting out new music and staying relevant for 20 years. And I guess I'm just curious, like, do you feel like there's another 20 years in you, or like, are there other careers you'd like to explore? Like, I'm just curious what's next.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. I feel a little bit of pressure, but
you should, right? No, it's two decades. It's on you.
Tegan and I love making things. I love to imagine a future where we continue to expand into other creative mediums. It was so thrilling and challenging to work on a memoir together, and it certainly exercised a different part of our creative muscle. I think the way that we approached the last 20 years was a bit like in panic survival mode. And I'd love to think that as 39 years old, that we're somewhat more established and we don't have to run on empty the way that we have for so many years. And I think also, too, like I've been having this really annoying adult voice in my brain lately where I see younger people starting out in the music industry. And I think to myself, boy, oh, boy, if I could just tell so-and-so it's a marathon, not a sprint. I think we really believed that in at least in the earlier part of our career, that there was this one song or one album or one moment that would establish us and that we would feel like we'd done it and then we could sort of like coast. And one of the things that sort of both a wonderful and exciting part of what we do and also something that's sort of like exhausting is that it just never feels like we're done. So I guess that's my way of saying I think we probably will be making things and making art for as long as we're lucky enough to be on this earth. I just think it's just who we are.
Tegan and Sarah, I guess, in turn, I hear what you guys are saying and I kind of welcome it. At the same time, listening to what Tegan said earlier about the need to create space for each of you having separate identities, right, in mm-hmm. high school, Simon and Garfunkel sounded great together. I mean, their harmonies are unbelievable. And yet at a certain point, at least one of them, actually both of them, wanted to establish separate identities. Could you imagine a future in which you're saying, you know what? I love this woman and she's my sister and I want her every success and yet I may need to figure out a way to be my own voice.
I mean, I think the one big difference between Simon and Garfunkel and us, I mean, there's many, but one is that they weren't identical twins. And I think that there's probably some part of us being family that means that we'll always have some connection to each other and create things together. But yes, I think both of us feel an intense desire to be our own people, to stand on our own. And we do, we like Sarah scored a film a couple years ago on her own. She also got involved in a television show up in Canada, you know, that about books. She's, you know, and like there are definitely adventures we go on as independent artists. I don't think either of us have any interest in becoming solo artists and music.
It's too much work.
Like, it's way too much work.
I like that Tegan does 50% of the work. Yeah. Like, I don't want to have to do all of it myself.
Yeah, neither of us is looking.
So when
at
you guys go
that.
Into book club, one of you reads the book and the other gets to be there too. We're speaking with the musical duo Tegan and Sarah about their 2-decade career and a journey back to their high school days, illustrated in a new memoir, heard on their latest album. Join our conversation. What questions do you have for Sarah and Tegan? How has their music influenced you? We'll segue with the song Closer. It's the lead single off Tegan and Sarah's 2013 album, Heartthrob. We'll have them back in just a moment. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Everything is awesome.
I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, living out the dream. This is On Point. Everything is awesome. At least it is when you listen to that theme track from the 2014 film The Lego Movie. It was performed by Tegan and Sarah at the Academy Awards. Be awesome. Join our conversation. What questions do you have for my guests, Tegan and Sarah? Sarah and Tegan. Follow us on the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us, as I said, Tegan Quinn and Sarah Quinn. Their new memoir is titled High School, and their latest album, Hey, I'm Just Like You. So tell me, Sarah, you guys write that. Everything is awesome. It's a huge hit. It's part of the Lego Movie. Andy Samberg's group does sort of a little live insert, you know, a fun little rapping insert in the middle of it. Did this feel like a lark and just like kind of fun, you know, prank to do in some ways? Or did this feel like, oh, it's a corporate gig. It's good exposure. What the hell? Let's do it.
Well, first, let me say we did not write it. I wish we had, because we'd be retired living on like a Caribbean island right now. But It was written by another duo who are fabulous songwriters, and we were asked to sing it. So we were in – I believe we were in Prague. We were somewhere on tour in Europe. And
it was cold.
It was very cold. We were in like a dark basement in a
– Very little was awesome.
In the – yeah.
Very little.
Actually, very, very little was awesome. And we were checking through our emails like we normally do, and our managers – they proposed this this situation of, would you be able to throw demo vocals down over top of this song? It's going to be for a movie, and we think it would be cool. The Lonely Islander involved. We know Andy Samberg, so we were very excited. And I have to be honest, it really came together in this sort of in this way that it, you know, dreams are made of, where you don't have to do much. You put some vocals on something, and Tegan went and recorded in Los Angeles, and I did some of the vocals at home where I was living in New York. But we really had no idea what was going to happen. We did the little bit of work we needed to do, and then a few months later, when the movie came out, we were absolutely caught off guard by how massive the song became and the opportunities that came because of the song becoming such a huge international hit and doing things like the Academy Awards. I mean, it just to imagine ourselves back in that little basement just singing "Everything Is Awesome" like into our computers. I mean, it was for 100 opportunities like that, you really don't end up with one like this one very often.
I mean, so basically at the time you're like, fine, it's the equivalent of singing a couple songs at a family member's friend's bar mitzvah or something. And you're like, we can do this. Okay. And it's huge. It blows up.
We clearly have no we must not know what a hit song is. I mean, maybe this is why we've always sort of like, it's a shot in the dark.
It's why you got to keep going for another 20 years. You guys clearly have no idea. Let's take a couple calls. A lot of your listeners and our listeners are calling in. We got one from Peyton calling in from Boston. Thanks for listening to the show. Thanks for listening to Tegan and Sarah. What are your questions for them?
Hey guys, my question is, did you guys feel any kind of fear or worry or nervousness about putting out a book about a time in your life when you guys were so extremely vulnerable?
That's a great question. And yes, we were definitely – Sarah and I both spent a lot of time while we were writing making sure that we were telling our story and not necessarily telling other people's stories, because a lot of the people that we wrote about in the book are still very close to us and still really involved in our life. And, you know, I think we were really focused on making sure that we weren't exposing anyone, any detail that didn't need to be there that might hurt anyone. We tried to take all of that out. Mostly, though, to be honest, we were driven by this desire to write something, to share a story that doesn't often get told. You know, we acknowledge that, you know, that as queer women, especially as creatives and musicians, that often our stories aren't told. And, you know, the opportunity to get to do that felt really important. There was a ton of purpose behind writing the book. It wasn't just a let's collect a paycheck and tell a salacious story and, you know, reach more people. Like it was not quite so gross. It was kind of like that, but then also mostly just about wanting to, give hope and tell our redemption story, be honest. I think queer people are often put into the media when you become popular, you're a public figure, is perfect. I came out, everything's great. Look how great my life is. Look how accepted and loved by society I am. And, you know, some of that's true, but the reality is that for a lot of, people in our community, it doesn't feel like that. And Sarah and I wanted to talk a little more about our life before we became public figures and before things got easier. And we just really felt like there was a lot of purpose in doing that. But we definitely spazzed out a lot over like, should we tell this? Is this going to bug people? Shockingly, people were mostly just really stressed out in our life about us talking about doing drugs as young people. And that didn't stress us out. That made us wish we'd written more about drugs. But that's for the next book, I suppose.
You guys did not exactly stint about writing about drugs. I mean, I got to say that I was like, wow, I was clearly not, into that particular vein of high school because, it was like, no, we're at the safe place with the rave where, and forgive me, parents out there, but you guys were like, no, we're going to drop acid with kids who care about us as opposed to kids who are going to do violence to us later, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there was a lot of that. Do you look back at that and say, boy, we're putting ourselves in perilous circumstances? Do you say, hey, it all led to this? We're playing in front of the Academy Awards. We don't do this now, but, you know, it's all part of the process to get here.
I mean, I think that it's important, you know, for us, we grew up in a time where, there was a lot of unsupervised time. Our parents were very busy. Our mother went back and got a bachelor's degree and a master's degree while we were in school and in during our adolescence. So she was working and going to school. There was a responsibility that we were going to be able to get ourselves to and from school and feed ourselves. And I look at the way kids are being raised now and I can see how this story would seem particularly shocking. We didn't feel we were being like neglected. We weren't like, running the streets or whatever. We still had a lot of structure, but there was an experimental side to us. And, you know, I say this a lot. I think psychedelic drugs do get a very specific reputation, especially when we're talking about girls. You know, I have lots of musician friends who are male and extremely open about their experimentation and opening their minds. I mean, probably the band everyone, especially men, love to talk about are the Beatles and how they revolutionized music and they did all of these things. And I want to be very clear. I'm not advocating for teenagers to be taking drugs. I understand how impressionable and how their brains are developing and all of these things. I cannot lie and deny that drugs had an impact on me and Tegan, and they allowed us to be creative and collaborative and fun. And in some ways, I know this sounds like it can't possibly be true, but because of the type of drugs we were doing and the type of community we were drawn to, I felt we were safe because we were with people like us. We were at raves that were so openly, welcoming to queer people and to women. And so many of the places that we were, would have been normal for us to go to, like the mall. I mean, we used to go to the mall and like people would threaten to beat us up, and there was like people prostituting, and there was violence, and there was shoplifting, and there was, I don't know, people trying to boot for getting beer or whatever. And we were just like hanging out on a couch listening to electronic music. You know, I don't know. It didn't feel that dangerous to me.
I guess the one difference with the Beatles, and I think that was Sarah, right?
Yeah.
There. One difference with the Beatles, they sort of came to it later as they were adults.
But is that
right?
Why? But that is true, and I do agree with that. But I also think that, you know, I don't think that's why we let guys off the hook. There's a whole generation of young people who have created, you know, fabulous genre-changing music who were probably doing drugs or drinking or experimenting at different times in their lives, whether it was young or it was old. I don't disagree that it's terrifying to think of a 15-year-old taking acid. I understand that. I really, really do. I just think that it's like – I also just think that there
– You want to be honest and true to your own experience.
I do. And you know what I also think is so interesting is that I was so prepared for adults to be – adults in our life and, you know, journalists and people to be shocked by our drinking, because when I look back at our youth, I mean the nights that were terrifying to me, the nights where there were great risks taken was around alcohol. The experiences
and that is totally true. And, I mean, people getting in cars and yes. people drinking too much. And you guys described, I think, at one point, falling down the stairs or something.
I broke my arm drinking. But, you know, when you look at what's happening, like even just in the United States around, you know, college and binge drinking and sexual assaults. And, you know, alcohol is it's a drug. It's a substance that I think is really, really terrifying. And I don't deny that LSD can be scary. But like, geez, when I was looking back at our adolescence, when I think about LSD, I'm sort of like, we were just pinned to the couch kind of having these like psychedelic experiences. It was really the alcohol that scared me when I went back and looked at that time.
Let's take a couple of calls now. Dayton, Ohio. Sean, thanks for listening to the show. Tell us your thoughts about Tegan and Sarah.
Hi, Tegan and Sarah. Yeah, I just talked about the music. You said earlier about how, you know, about not being different than Simon and Garfunkel. I think it's awesome that, you know, you guys have your you can do your own thing on each album, and I often feel like, you know, Tegan's songs are like having a really intense conversation. Sarah's songs are more like just feeling raw emotion sometimes, but my 5-year-old daughter loves you. It's charming to hear her sing Tegan and Sarah's songs to herself sometimes.
That's great, Sean.
That's so awesome.
Appreciate that. I want to drop in a song just to give listeners another taste of some of the music we're talking about. Here's the track 19. It was written by Tegan Quinn and featured on their 2007 album, The Con.
I felt you in my legs before I ever met you. And when I lay beside you, for the first time I told you. I feel you in my heart.
Tegan, you've said of 19, this was probably the first song that I wrote that had a connection with the audience, which I hadn't yet had a song accomplish. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, to date, at that point, you know, the biggest song we'd ever had was a song called Walking with a Ghost, which Sarah had written. And, you know, we had a great size audience up to that point. But when we started to get radio play with Walking with a Ghost, our audience grew exponentially. And the next record we put out was The Con. And, you know, right away, within months of the record coming out,
you know, we were playing these massive theaters. And when I would play that song in particular, 19, it's just, it was an overwhelming effect that happened. You know, I remember this one show specifically. It was in Edmonton, Alberta, and it was at a big, beautiful performing arts center, three stories. And the ushers were telling everyone to sit down the whole night. There was a tug of war happening in the theater, and it was really distracting from stage. People wanted to stand, wanted to, you know, feel the music, and the ushers kept telling everyone to sit down. And so before I started 19, I told everyone to close their eyes and imagine they were standing. And, you know, people chuckled, but I, you know, had them put up the house lights. And I said, no, seriously, like all of you, all 3,000 of you, close your eyes and just imagine you're standing. It'll feel the same. And as we started to play the song, I swear to you, people with their eyes closed just all started to stand. And like by the middle of the song, 3,000 people were on their feet and the ushers just gave up. And I just can remember like it feeling so powerful. That record was so emotional. It would really take on a life of its own that over the next 2 years after that came out. You know, that was when that's when we really became Tegan and Sarah.
Sarah, you guys, you know, start to make it, and it's a really fun recounting of the contest you get into, you know, where you're basically like, hey, guys, we're going to have to go to college if we don't win this contest. So, you know, root for us, basically. And you guys start to make it. One of the things you've described is that since then, you guys really encountered just kind of reflexive default kind of sexism, homophobia, whatever, within this industry that we think of as very creative. And you experienced it both in terms of the industry and also in terms of folks who are kind of on my side of the ledger in music journalism.
Yeah, true.
So give people a feel for what that's like.
You know, it's tough. I want to be clear, and you know, I think, you know, as a teenager, it was very specific. I mean, we were, you know, we sort of defer now to this kind of like, I'm sure it was very awkward to be like a 35-year-old man interviewing a 17-year-old. I think that they struggled with the language. They struggled to know what was appropriate, how to talk to us, how to write about us. And certainly things have changed in the last 20 years. But I think there's this natural instinct, you know, to look at who we are and to want to write about it as a curiosity, as something that is, you know, strange or a fetish or, you know, something that isn't for the writer or for the journalist. And I think we experienced that in a way that was striking, especially because we were music people who loved so many different bands and, you know, would read and listen to the interviews of our peers. And it was so obvious that we were being treated very differently than a band that we like. I don't know. I'm just, they're popping in my brain. Arcade Fire. I lived in Montreal during the rise of Arcade Fire. And I just would always think like, why is it necessary for us to be spoken of in this way? And when I say spoken of in this way, I mean like in a sexual way. Just because we were gay did not mean that we were inviting people to, you know, to talk about us as objects, as sexual objects. And I think, you know, I think that things were so – it was such a different time. There wasn't the same kind of accountability. Social media certainly was different. And there was really no way for us to hold people accountable. And often when we did, you know, we sort of would be sort of facing you know, an uphill battle. And again, this stuff still happens to this day, and it's a little bit less insidious, but just to go back to, you know, a reference point, Lonely Island. We played the Academy Awards, and Rolling Stone a few years ago tweeted out, you know, their top 10 Academy Award moments, Academy Award moments of all time, musical moments. And we were on the list, except that the tweet really annoyed me because it said, Canadian lesbian duo Tegan and Sarah perform with The Lonely Island on the Academy Awards. And I tweeted back, Canadian lesbian duo is so proud to have performed with heterosexual trio Lonely Island. And in that context,
it sounds so dumb.
When you say it like that,
it's like
everyone,
Florida man, right?
Yes, like so everyone mad. Is like, oh my God, that's absurd. And it's like sometimes I feel like we've spent 20 years trying to point out to people that you cannot say these things or do these things without it having a sort of having an impact. Well, and I mean, that's a very like radio friendly example. We have certainly seen the gauntlet of horrors.
So let us honor each of you individually, both of you as a duo, acknowledge your music, not just your awards, the new memoir you've written, High School, and the new album, Hey, I'm Just Like You. Sarah Quinn, great to have you with us today.
Ah, thank you.
Tegan Quinn, thanks for being here as well, the two of you together.
Thank you.
Close this hour with one more track from the new album, a song, All I Have to Give the World Is Me. We are appreciative of it. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.